Good afternoon. My name is Andres, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Trust Company investment call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. If you should need assistance during the call, please press star, then zero, and an operator will come back online to assist you. Thank you. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Judy Bricker. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Judy Bricker, Director of Corporate Marketing of the Sanibel Captiva Trust Company and its divisions, the Tampa Bay Trust Company, and the Naples Trust Company. I'll be your moderator today with our experts Ian Bruch, Chief Investment Officer, and Tim Vick, Director of Research. As a reminder, the questions for today's call were provided in advance by call participants. Information presented is for educational purposes only and does not intend to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities product, service, or investment strategy. Investments involve risk, unless otherwise stated, are not guaranteed. Be sure to first consult with your qualified financial advisor, tax professional, or attorney before implementing any strategy or recommendation discussed on today's call. Ian and Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Judy.
We've adjusted the format of our investment call so we dive right into our clients' questions rather than providing an overview of recent financial developments. No doubt this 30-minute Q&A will cover that content as we go along, so let's get started. The first quarter of 2017 was pretty positive for the stock market. What were your main takeaways, and what do you think drove the markets higher?
Well, thanks, Judy, and good afternoon. I think, you know, as we look back, first quarter of 2017 and even extending beyond into 2016, we saw quite a few things rally, obviously, post-presidential election. Many of the companies in the financial materials industrial space rallied to new highs. We saw interest rates move considerably higher. More recently, I'd say just, you know, April, May, we've seen some of that at least take a pause and in many places pull back a little bit. Much of what was built on the back of expectations, I think people are starting to think a little bit more rationally about those moves and deciding if it's wise to keep pumping money towards speculation or if it's wise to just sit on the sidelines and see what actually happens before deploying further money. Solid corporate profits, you know, we're through the first quarter at this point, so we've gotten the report cards in a lot of our companies at this point, and I think Tim and I were generally pleased with the results. So good corporate profits out of the companies we own. And then from an economic standpoint, we continue to move along. No major hiccups in the economy from the data that we look at. So that also portends to good things in the future as well.
Yeah, hi, this is Tim, and I agree with what Ian just said. There's been a continuation of economic trends going back to the summer of last year, where we started seeing evidence really around the world that economies were starting to pick up here in the United States, Europe, China, Asia, Japan, and the market is always forward-looking. It's looking ahead 6 to 9 months to try to anticipate further economic growth, further growth in profits, and this is all independent of what happened with our own election. So I think we had some positive trends in place, and right after the election, you put the combination of the rising economic growth with some positive trends out of Washington in terms of things that would prosper businesses, and that was a good cocktail, I think, for creating a market that was going to rally.
The market seems to be exhibiting low volatility right now and is shaking off a lot of positive and negative news. Why is that?
Well, it's true. I mean, we did see markets move considerably higher a few months ago, but more recently it's been more of a sideways pattern with not a lot of positive or negative movement in one direction or the other. If we do get a little bit of a negative day, it's usually followed by a positive day. So we've been in that trading range for a few months now. I think it just comes back to, you know, the economic data that we're seeing is fairly solid, and most of the news is surrounded or is really having to do more with politics than anything. So it actually, I think it makes sense that there's not a lot of volatility in the market, because the things that should cause volatility have been rather rather boring, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. So economically, we're in good shape, and as I said, we moved through corporate earnings season in good fashion. So you know, less news is good news in this case.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think if you're an investor, you've got to separate where the positive and negative news events are coming from. All the positive news is coming out of the economic data. All the negative news seems to be coming out of the political centers like Paris and Washington and London. So I think I would prefer the positives coming out of the economic data.
How much impact do you think the election results are still having on stocks?
Oh, I think it's huge. I mean, we saw an example last week where, you know, the stock market got wind of, you know, the firing of the FBI director. It fell for two straight days. Not a big correction by any stretch, but you saw immediately the market has rebounded and, you know, rebounded and got all that decline back. So these are the types of daily fluctuations we're going to have to deal with near term, you know, daily, not only an interday as well. There's a lot of money staked to the news cycle. Probably in excess of $1 trillion every day is staked to how the news is, you know, oscillating. But to us, it's always been daily noise. I mean, politics, you know, has very little impact on stock prices long term. Short term, it can move things for a day, for a week, but longer term, it has very little impact. This is a point Ian and I made over and over in January, February, March, and we were doing presentations to the clients in our various markets, that you have to divorce your political feelings from, you know, your investing goals. Because if you want to hit your investing goals, you really have to focus on economic fundamentals and kind of ignore what's going on in, you know, in our political capitals.
So you think the market will keep reacting to Washington throughout the year?
I am afraid so.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the market, as I said, is moved by traders, and markets react to news, and the news right now is very, very Trump-centric, if that's a term. And, you know, and I can't blame the media for doing that. The media is at war with Donald Trump. You know, about 95% of our daily newspapers supported Hillary Clinton, and many of these papers are now, you know, asking for him to be impeached or be investigated and certainly not giving him the benefit of the doubt. And that's creating an environment, I think, where news stories are going to be more inflamed than normal. And whether, wherever you stand politically, you have to understand that the way you're looking at news right now is has changed drastically. And this is where you really, really have to divorce, you know, your political opinions from, you know, the cold, hard economic facts, which are a lot more positive than what's coming out of Washington. So, you know, to answer that question, yes, I think the market is still going to keep reacting because the market reacts to news.
What do you gentlemen see as the biggest impacts or shocks that Washington can have on the financial markets this year?
Yeah, I think three main ones come to my mind, at least. I think healthcare reform, that's yet to be decided on. That's going to have an impact on things. And then tax reform, both corporate and individual, will also have a big impact. If we just think on the corporate side, if you all of a sudden drop more cash to the bottom line of income statements, all of those companies become intrinsically more valuable. And then the third being, I think, tax repatriation, bringing overseas cash back to the U.S. We've had many, many companies that have been parking cash overseas to avoid paying taxes. If that could come back stateside, you know, I think that would be a huge benefit to the shareholder class in this country, because you'd see a lot of companies probably doing share buybacks, maybe some special dividends, things like that.
I would agree with that. I mean, if you're looking for what could shock, you know, investors the most, it's that Washington carries through on what it promises. I mean, the expectations are extremely low right now for Congress and extremely low for President Trump. And if Congress can methodically take on health care and improve upon the system that they're trying to unravel, if they can methodically take on tax reform and trade deals and lift some regulations, not only that would that shock the market, but it would be a positive shock. And those are things I would be looking forward to this year.
What impact are lower tax rates going to have on investors?
I think the market's already priced lower tax rates into equity prices. We have seen that the Trump administration has proposed lowering the corporate tax rate from 35% down to as low as 15%, although we think it would probably settle closer to 20%. And then we've seen a move to eliminate some personal tax brackets and reduce the number of brackets from 7 down to 3, and then eliminate the estate tax and a few others. These are all positives if they get implemented as proposed. The stock market in general has already discounted that, we feel, because we've looked at a lot of companies and where they're paying their taxes and what their effective rates are, and we noticed almost immediately that the stocks that were rallying the most after Donald Trump was elected were the companies that either were headquartered here in the United States, were smaller companies, and were paying the full effective rate of 35%. You know, if those companies suddenly are taxed at only 15 or 20%, it immediately makes these companies 25, 30% more valuable, and voila, we saw 25 and 30% rallies in those stocks. And so the market has reflected already the shock right now that could happen is if Congress just abandons tax reform and keeps things the way they are, because we've had some rallies that are, I think, fully premised on tax reform being implemented.
The Federal Reserve also kept interest rates the same at their last meeting. Was that just a pause, or do you see rates continuing to move higher?
We see that as a pause. I mean, we do see higher rates into the future, though I think probably more slowly than everyone's anticipating. So they did a few just in the last few months. We'd expect maybe September would be their next rate hike, and then as soon as they make that move, the market will kind of weigh in and decide if that was justified or not, and we'll see what the yield curve does. I don't think we expect markedly higher interest rates anytime soon. I think at the margin they will increase. The Fed will raise them as much as they can. But there are some real reasons that are going to keep a little bit of a buffer on interest rates from going materially higher as well. If we continue to raise rates while the rest of the world does not, that puts upward pressure on our dollar, and that has its own implications for stock prices. So it's not an easy road for the Fed to just continue to raise interest rates. They're going to have to do it one by one and then let the market kind of parse out what it thinks.
Just to follow up then, how do you think stock and bond prices will react to more rate increases?
Well, on the bond side, the math is very simple. When interest rates rise, bond prices will fall. That's just what's going to happen on that side of things. We've had many decades of good moves in bond prices as interest rates have moved down. The opposite effect will happen if interest rates rise. Bond prices will be hurt, which is why we are telling our clients, just be wary of the interest rate risk inside your portfolio. If you do own bonds, we'd be happy to help clients with that, making sure that they're not overexposed to interest rate risk. That's something we think quite a bit about. On the stock side, we think you should be okay. I parse out dividend stocks. Those have been used as substitutes for fixed income over the past several years. So you may see prices on dividend stocks pull back a little bit as interest rates rise. But longer term, again, dividend-paying companies grow their revenue and earnings as well. And so they'll be fine long term.
Given how fixed income markets have reacted lately, have you made any adjustments in portfolios?
Yeah, I mean, interest rates have increased, like we've said. So, yes, at the margin we've been making changes, particularly for clients that need income and maybe already had a portion of their account in bonds where bonds are appropriate. But the changes have been very marginal. Even though we had a large move in interest rates recently, we are still a long way away from what we would consider to be historically normal interest rates. And the relative value between stocks and bonds is still very wide, meaning we still favor stocks over bonds, all else being equal. So we're still a ways away from bonds making sense as a more meaningful portion. So to answer the question, adjustments in portfolios to this point have been very, very minimal.
Mm-hmm. Well, we don't see rates skyrocketing anytime in the future and likely will not escalate much over, where they are right now. There's still a lot of slack capacity around the world, not here in the United States, but certainly elsewhere. And if you go back to areas and times when we had booms, like the commodity boom of 2006-2007. That was a point at which oil was $147 a barrel, and copper and zinc and corn and soybeans were all hitting multi-year highs simultaneously. Even then, we only had 2.5-3% inflation in the United States. And if inflation can't be pushed up higher than that in that type of environment, we doubt we can see higher inflation anytime soon. And higher inflation is what really drives interest rates higher. So don't want to scare investors into thinking that higher rates are right around the corner. We see them moving up just gradually. And as we do, the couple of adjustments we'll make will be to inflation protect portfolios. Now, if we're owning a lot of things that are generating coupon interest or dividends, we want those dividends more inflation protected. And certainly if rates move up materially to where we're getting 4.5-5% yields just on, let's say, corporate bonds, we'll want to lock that in, because we have a lot of clients who would love to just live off 4-5% yields the rest of their lives.
For the past couple of years, the trust company has relied a lot on dividends and income from non-traditional sources like oil and gas pipeline companies and preferred stocks. Do you still like them, and would they continue to be held in a rising rate climate?
Yes, we still like them. I would parse out the two, though. Preferred stocks, we like them. There's less supply today than there was a few years ago in terms of what we like in that space. So that's one limitation. But generically speaking, yes, we're still a fan. And then oil and gas pipeline companies, those are a different breed. What we like about them is you're finding, anywhere from let's call it 3 to 6% in terms of distribution yield per year. And most of the time, on an average, in an average case, those distributions are growing at another 4 to 5%. So there's your inflation protection. You get a nice hefty dividend that's also growing at a pace that's going to be higher than inflation as well. So that won't avoid prices moving around. If interest rates move up dramatically, these income stocks will probably fall in price. But you have to take a long-term view. And we think the fundamentals of these businesses still make sense, even in a rising interest rate environment.
Tim, in our latest newsletter, you mentioned that valuations of many asset classes are closer to their highs than their lows. Can you expound on that comment, and has the situation changed?
Well, first, I think you got to draw back to early 2009, the first quarter of 2009, and that's when our economy last troughed, and that was 8 years ago. So for 8 years, we've seen a steady increase in just revenues of companies. Their earnings have escalated quite a bit. Their returns on equity and returns on invested capital have kept rising, and that is going to move the valuation needle. Back in 2009, you could buy most stocks at, or many great stocks, at 9 and 10 times earnings and 6 times cash flow, and that was a buyer's market. You could buy everything on the cheap, furniture, houses, cars, art, stocks, everything was put on sale in 2009. Today, you're in a kind of more of a seller's market. The same stocks that cost you 9 and 10 times earnings in 2009 are now costing you 19 and 20 times earnings and 12 times cash flow, and you'll have to be a lot more selective. So the situation really has not changed to the point where it'll take either a vast correction in the market or a great acceleration of economic activity to really move the needle on valuations. To us, the key is going to be interest rates. Warren Buffett made a very, I think, salient comment in his annual meeting 2 weeks ago where he said, if interest rates stay this low for a prolonged period of time into the future, stocks will prove to be very cheap. And he's dead on right on that account. If interest rates move up steadily, it will slowly undercut valuation levels. And I think it just further behooves us to be very selective with stocks, make sure that anything we're buying right now for clients can hit their rate of return targets. If you ask me that, can we find a lot of things that can generate 5% total returns? Yes, we can today. 6%? Yes. If you ask for 10 or 12%, the answer would be no, because that would have been a yes 5 or 6 years ago. But, you know, the valuation levels have changed, and what that means is your forward rate of returns have changed.
You also mentioned that monetary policy and fiscal policy seem to be diverging. The Federal Reserve is tightening while Congress seems willing to increase spending. How do you see that playing out?
That's an interesting question. I think that gets to the ability and willingness of Washington to want to stimulate our economy further. The Federal Reserve stepped in to reliquify the banking system in 2009 by gobbling up a lot of bonds that might not have been bought by buyers at that time, and allowed governments to float more debt. Right now, they're trying to unload those bonds, so they're not going to be stimulating. And it's up to Congress now to act in a stimulative fashion to help investors. And if they expound on their ideas of corporate tax cuts, infrastructure spending, I think those are going to be stimulative, and that'll be very effective. If all we see in the next few years is just an expansion of more social policies and social programs, basically it's going to be just wealth transfer in this country, not something that's going to be very stimulative. So we'll see. It's not something that overly concerns us right now, but Washington is still going to try to stimulate where they can in the future, but it's going to come from Congress rather than Federal Reserve.
Yeah, it's you know, the two are diverging for the first time in many years. You've got monetary policy moving in one direction, fiscal moving in the other. So that net effect of stimulus is really largely unknown.
Right.
Have there been any trend changes in 2016?
I think the biggest trend change was the market's posturing from being very defensive last year to being growth-oriented here just in the last 6 or 7 months. We started 2016, if you recall, very worried that Asia and emerging markets, and particularly China, was going to fall into a recession and drag a lot of other economies with it. So American investors, European investors got very, very defensive and started bidding up prices of high dividend-paying blue chips. Stocks like AT&T, which I think was up like 24% last year and beat Google and Facebook, and you know, Chevron and Kraft and electric utilities and oil and gas pipeline companies, these were all enjoying 20 and 25% rallies last year, unheard of, really, except in times of market defensiveness, which is what we saw. And then as the economy started gathering strength toward the end of last year, coupled with the election, I think it just unearthed some latent growth tendencies, and we saw a complete reversal toward the end of last year, where the market just gave up on the defensives and started putting their money into growth stocks. And I think that was very apt, and you know, it was forward-looking.
We have some questions about technology stocks. What is behind their strong rally?
Well, if we go back to 2016, I mean, I think a lot of technology companies, and I'm speaking very broadly, just as a basket of stocks, largely underwhelmed in 2016. And then 2017, you've seen the reversal where they've really led the market. And we try not to put too much emphasis on those short-term moves because we see sectors and industries that at any particular time, they can kind of divorce themselves from fundamentals, meaning it doesn't always make sense why a basket of stocks is up 10% or down 10% over a short period of time. We've seen that with tech. Again, focus on the individual companies. We make sure we own good quality companies that are growing their revenue and earnings in excess of what you could find more broadly. I think maybe, you know, if we're tying it back to something new that's occurred in the world, tech companies would be the biggest benefactor to some sort of tax repatriation happening. I think those have been the biggest, you know, companies like Apple and Cisco come to mind. They have billions overseas. If that could come back stateside, that would be huge for them. That may be, you know, more of a political reason than anything.
The trust company, how does the trust company view some of the tech leaders like Apple, Google, and Facebook?
Yeah, I think, you know, Google and Facebook, they're a little bit different than Apple today. You know, Apple is a fantastic company. We still own it in many accounts. We're not currently buying Apple. It's a little bit of an in-between type company where obviously clearly a fantastic business, but it's not going to grow like it has over the last decade. And it's also not paying us the type of dividend that, for example, we're getting from a Microsoft today, a much more mature business. They're in that transition period. They're sort of doing what Microsoft did 10 years ago, becoming more mature, allocating capital in a different way. And so we're holding off from that standpoint. Google and Facebook very much in growth mode, redeploying all their excess cash back into the business, achieving good results. So we like all three of them for different reasons. We're currently buying Google and Facebook in our growth portfolios because they are, in fact, growing.
You know, also, information technology in general is playing a bigger role in our growth portfolios, and I think it should because it's playing a bigger role in the economy in general. And the way we've looked at it is we'd rather own the picks, companies that sell picks and shovels rather than the companies that do the actual mining. So, you know, in that context, rather than own an old-fashioned lending institution like a small bank, we just say we want the transaction part of that, and we own MasterCard and Visa. Instead of owning a retailer outright, we'd rather own the company that does the processing of the online purchase, like a PayPal or maybe a Priceline. And we dabble in cybersecurity with a company called Checkpoint, which we think will do well for us long term. We're in the outsourcing, you know, component of information technology with a company called Cognizant Technologies. And just recently, we looked at cloud computing and virtual reality type companies and found a company called VMware, which we've just recently added, and we hope that'll do well for us.
What trends are you noticing in the first quarter earnings reports that just came out?
Well, we've looked at dozens and dozens so far, and of the 90 or so companies that we follow very closely, I think about 80 or 81 of them reported, and almost three-quarters of them exceeded our expectations and exceeded the market's expectations in terms of either sales growth or profit growth, which is a really good sign. Typically, it's closer to 60 or 70%, and when you get to 75, that meant these companies are genuinely outperforming, and there's some genuine economic trends that's leading to that outperformance. We only saw about a quarter of the companies lag, but they didn't lag by very much. So by and large, I thought those numbers looked good. We noticed that year over year, it looks like S&P 500 companies will grow about 12% from the first quarter of last year. In the second quarter, perhaps another 12% year over year. Those are really strong numbers, and it tells us that the rallies we've seen in the market have been justified. We looked at a lot of companies internally and noticed what's in portfolios right now is these companies are showing an average return on equity of about 18%, a return on capital of about 13%, and net profit margins are 15%. These are all numbers that tell us that growth can be continuous, that management's effectively allocating capital, and we can see, or we would expect continued appreciation in share price.
There were a couple of questions about companies that faced difficulty recently. Disney was one and Synchrony was the other. What are your current views on both of those?
I'll touch on Disney first, Tim. You know, I think if Disney is a large conglomerate of different businesses, really, and when I think about the numbers, about 75 to 80% of their revenue is doing extremely well, which is tied to the movie studio business and also the park business. So the movie franchise continues to do really well, and the parks, let's use Shanghai as an example, they were cash flow positive much sooner than anyone had anticipated. So those portions of the business are doing really well. ESPN, which makes up about 20-25% of Disney's revenue, is the one sort of sour spot. That's the part of the business. They're a lot, like a lot of content providers, they're struggling with you know, the changing landscape of the cable business. So, you know, you have a fourth of their business that's a little bit up in the air, but you've got three-fourths of the business that's really doing well. We have confidence in management that long-term they have a handle on the ESPN thing, and they'll do fine into the future. Certainly a risk we're willing to continue to take with Disney.
And with Synchrony, we're having a situation where the company missed an earnings estimate because they took some reserves for loan losses that they expect in the future, and that kind of shocked analysts who were not expecting this to occur. And Capital One, 2 days earlier, I think, had announced the same thing and took higher reserves. And the reason being that these companies are growing awfully fast. The average bank is only growing its loans by low single-digit numbers right now, and Synchrony is growing its loans and its receivables by 10 and 12% a year, so growing 3 and 4 times faster than the industry, which is one of the reasons we like it. And they, really given a cautious outlook, anticipate more normalized economic trends and more normalized loan losses in the future. And I think they're being extra cautious in reserving ahead of time. That took the analysts by surprise. The stock got knocked down one day. And as we looked at it and scrubbed the numbers and listened to management, we felt we still had an excellent franchise here that was growing, where it's going to grow off a lower earnings base for the next couple of quarters. But then the growth will start kicking in, and we're looking at a company that's now trading at about 10 times its earnings with a lot of growth to it. So it's still favorable in our minds.
What about GE, Tim?
Well, I've got to say that one's on a shorter leash. We've been fans of General Electric and some of its strategies for at least a dozen years now, but the underperformance is starting to just replicate itself, and that worries us. We've got other industrial companies in portfolios like Honeywell or 3M, you know, vast conglomerates with disparate assets all over the world that have far outstripped the performance of General Electric. And General Electric certainly was, you know, is its own victim because it sold off GE Capital, which was one of the most profitable divisions, which permanently lowered its threshold of earnings going forward. And at the same time, it's been acquiring other oil and gas and power system type companies. It just means to us that the growth is going to stagnate near term. I was very disappointed to see over the last 2 quarters that General Electric's cash flows have turned negative, and that's something that just shouldn't happen to a cyclical industrial in this stage of the economic cycle. That's a worrisome trend for me. So we're going to keep it on a short leash and try to find a substitute perhaps.
Okay. There's so much chatter these days about the death of retailers and how Amazon and eBay are pinning the industry to the mat. Is the negative publicity just hype? Are you bottom fishing the sector? Which companies do you think can keep their growth going?
It's certainly not all hype. I mean, I think the Amazon effect is very real. Online spending continues to grow double digits every year, year in, year out. That doesn't seem to be dissipating anytime soon. So, you know, when Amazon gets into a market and does it well, you know, the old line retailers really struggle. Clearly, you know, the Macy's, the Sears, the JCPenney's of the world are struggling for obvious reasons. There are some positive retailers out there, like the Home Depots and some of the auto part manufacturers or distributors like O'Reilly and Advanced Auto Parts. So there are some bright spots within retail where it's been a little harder for Amazon to compete or just in markets where they've yet to really dive in. Now, are we bottom fishing the sector? Unfortunately, no, and that's just a function of the fact that there's not much bottom fishing to be had at this point because the retailers that you would want to own have generally done well, and they're not cheap today. So there's certainly value to be had with some of the names that I had mentioned earlier, like a JCPenney's or a Sears, but there's a tremendous amount of risk with those names as well. So we're continuing to watch them. We do own some retail, but you've got to be very careful in that space. We do think the whole Amazon effect is very real.
Let's do one more quick question. In regard to real estate investment trusts, are you concerned at all about their exposure to retail?
I mean, as it pertains to our holdings, not really, because you know, I think about the three real estate investment trusts that we own a lot of, two of which are primarily healthcare-oriented, so hospital beds and skilled nursing and retirement homes. That's much stickier business than a strip mall, so to speak. Realty Income is the one that would be exposed to that space, but they're very well diversified. In addition to some of the strip mall assets, they've got a bunch of CVS and drugstore shops that are much more sticky. And they're so well diversified that one area of the market can underperform and they can still hit their cap rate targets and do quite well.
And they have a lot of freestanding convenience stores too, which is a very sticky business. Their occupancy rates on all their properties is hovering around 99%. Their leases turn over at very slow rates, and they're well capitalized with a lot of long-term fixed rate debt. So they have not shown any proclivity to be influenced by these retail trends that Amazon's causing.
Thank you. That concludes our questions for today. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Judy.
We thank you for joining us from Tampa Bay to Marco Island. And if you have any additional questions not addressed on today's call, the Trust Company's wealth managers will be happy to visit with you one-on-one. Until next time, thank you.
And this concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.